Okay, so if you just came in, you can pick up your quizzes if you didn't pick them up after class. As I emailed you, I really don't like this chapter too much because there's a lot of just memorization work. First, welcome back from spring break. I know it's hard to get back in the cycle of everything, but there's six more weeks. You can do it. Keep going. But there's a lot of memory work with this content right here because we're just seeing hormone after hormone after hormone. And then some of the mechanisms. The best thing over the years people to study for this is really to take note cards, write the hormone on the top, you know, on the front page and on the back, then list where does it come from, where is the target, what does it do, right? And then you might even list hyperfunction or a hypofunction, right? And that way it's good for your MCAT studying or DSET studying or whatever you might be studying for a professional exam, but also for here. It's just a lot of memory work.
Have like a list of the things we need to memorize, or
did you just kind of spread the main things that we cover here, but what we're going to do is to go through these hormones systematically a bit and then talk about some general groups like reproductive hormones or ones that control glucose, development, for example. So it's kind of the way it goes in groups, and that might be the easiest approach to kind of keep it together. But we'll hit the main ones. Some of the tables, if you're looking at different texts or even on the PowerPoints, there's a lot of content on there, and so there's just too much to, and there's no reason to memorize it all. But the main points that you should at least go away with the physiology course, okay? And if some of you had the intro anatomy and phys, you know, this is a refresher. If you're going to take 412G, you're going to get the same thing over and over again. If you've taken vertebrate endocrinology, which is a really good course, anybody take that this semester? No? Oh, you did? Pretty good, right? No? Yes? Maybe? Not sure? You don't want the same thing? Okay. I won't put your name on it. But you probably covered these content in more than depth, so it might be a breeze for you. So everybody study with her. No. Put you on the spot. Okay. So just some general comments to go through first, and then there is it's going to go pretty quick because it is just pretty much rote memory in some of this aspect. So some of the differences to remember: autocrine, paracrine, endocrine. What do we mean by that? Autocrine, back on itself, auto, right? So you can have something released, it can go right back to the same tissue and have a feedback. Usually it's a negative feedback process. Paracrine means out and then influencing neighboring tissue, around the cell, but not necessarily through the bloodstream, okay? When we talk about endocrine action, we mean through the bloodstream. And people over the years have asked, well, what about invertebrates, for example? It's not blood, but it's called hemolymph, which is the same thing as blood. So yes, invertebrates use endocrine responses that travel through the hemolymph that then works on target tissue. So we've had people confused with that on exams before. So it's not just blood. Hemolymph, you can use that together as blood. And the neuroendocrine means release from the neural cells that goes into the bloodstream. Okay, so, and I think you remember pheromones, right? We've talked about that a little bit with the sensory system. And it is amazing how these animals, like the hawk moth, for example, you might have seen the pictures with the sensory antennae that are out and all that big surface area, but they can detect such low levels, you know, one part per million of an odorant, you know, so it's really amazing. And then a lot of people study this in understanding insects. And why might you think people are interested in pheromonal action in insects? Any idea? Why would people be interested in pheromones in insects? Why would the Department of Agriculture and fund people to study that? Any ideas? Where do you get your fruit from? Fruit trees, right? How do the fruit trees make fruit? Pollination, right? Well, what about insects that infest a crop and destroy a crop, right? So people have actually came up with pheromones. There was a really neat article last year from Australia where they were looking at the sex hormone to attract moths to go to these sites where they could capture them and then kill them out because they were destroying a crop. So you can actually use this as an attractant to get insects to go to a certain location and actually try to then capture say insects that are destructive to a crop, for example. There's some really neat things out there that people have looked at with insects and even crustaceans. For example, I think I mentioned about the crayfish, your favorite animal, I know, the Procambrus clarkii, the red swamp crayfish. In Japan, they actually brought those to Japan a long time ago because what they were doing was they were putting them in the rice crops in the fields, you know, where they flood the rice, to then have another crop, the crayfish, to eat, right? So they put them in those rice crops because it's already water, they grow the rice, and then they had crayfish. The problem was the Procambrus, which are really from Louisiana, that area, in southern Texas, is that they're very destructive. They actually dig burrows, right? So here's these terraced lands in Japan where they have rice crops, and then they put these crayfish in, and then they dug all these holes in their terraced and destroyed their terraced. So there was actually a national campaign to get rid of crayfish in Japan that were introduced, and they just took over because they didn't have any predation on them, and trying to figure out ways to get rid of them. A group in England actually found a way that there's a pheromone that crustaceans release to try to attract at least the male crayfish so they can then capture them and try to get them out. I don't know where it stands today, but you can imagine. I mean, think about how that could change, you know, and cost millions of dollars in destruction if they can't get rid of those animals. But like many things, introduced species, like for weed control or erosion control, right? Kudzu introduced. Actually, marijuana was introduced by the Department of Transportation in the States as a erosion control. And then they figured out, hey, that's not so great. And then they started cutting it down. There's still places, supposedly, like in Alabama and places where it grows up on the side of the road because of the planting by the Department of Transportation to actually control erosion. So weird things. But introducing species that don't have the natural predators and things like that, you can really see how dangerous that is. Anyways, pheromones through the air or through the water to look at an animal. And then you can, I know we don't have a histology course right now, but we used to have one. You learn so much in histology because you can look at a cell type and understand a lot about it. If you looked at a neuroendocrine cell, for example, or a cell that was really producing a lot of hormones, what might you expect to be inside there? You know, energy-demanding process, a lot of mitochondria, and probably a lot of ER, right, to make those proteins, ribosomes, compared to other cells. So you learn a lot in histology, but the idea here is that you can have cells that release substances out into the blood or into fluid that's just exocytose, like a secretory vesicle, much like synaptic transmission, but a little bit different. Some of these can just kind of fuse and ooze out their contents. So it's kind of neat, too. So exocytosis process, and we'll look at a little bit of that. When we covered synaptic transmission before at the neuromuscular junction, or nerve to a nerve, remember, action potential comes down the nerve. What do we see down at the nerve terminal? Something different. What's the main difference down at the nerve terminal? Just the general point. We got vesicles. How do those vesicles fuse? What causes them to fuse?
Calcium.
So then we have to have what to let the calcium in? Voltage-gated calcium channels. So at the nerve terminal, like neuroendocrine cells, just like a regular nerve, you're going to have calcium influx, right? So you have to have voltage-gated calcium channels. But if you want something to secrete for a long time, longer than just a millisecond, like a neuromuscular junction, then you see in neuroendocrine cells a wider action potential. So these are wider or longer in duration, then more vesicles can fuse if you want to release more of the contents. You see something like this when we get to the cardiovascular system again. The action potentials in your ventricular muscles, the muscles to the base of your heart, those ventricular muscles, fibers, they actually have really wide action potentials. Why? Because then more calcium will come in to those muscle fibers and actually cause a stronger contraction. Because remember, the rate of calcium going in and out causes it to beat faster, relax back, you know, beat, relax, right? Like the boatfish or the shaker muscle, kind of refreshing your memory. But in the ventricular muscle, you don't want that to go so fast. You want it to have a strong, forceful contraction and inject the blood from your ventricles, right? So the action potentials in your ventricular muscles, in your heart, are usually long, 100 milliseconds instead of 1 millisecond, 100 milliseconds or longer, and that keeps a long contraction going. But same kind of analogy here, a longer action potential in the nerve terminal, more calcium is going to come in, more vesicles are going to fuse and release transmitters. Don't get confused with the muscle, right? That's for muscle contraction. This is for transmission. But the same idea. So usually neurosecretory cells, what we'll talk about in the hypothalamus, the posterior pituitary, have longer action potentials. Why we're talking about action potentials, nobody got the $100 yet. Nobody found that article with the neuromuscular junction, direct measures of the action potential, right? That's still there. No one's found it yet. Hopefully somebody this year will get it. Right? Everybody remember the bet, right? You know? Okay, so the same idea. You know, you think about, have people really measured this? Kind of by inference? Things like this. So, just as we mentioned, endocrine cells releasing into the bloodstream. So you can imagine then there has to be a tight apposition, or maybe a compound that can go across the cell membrane, like steroids. But also to cause vesicular fusion, that calcium can come from extracellular, but also what? Intracellular. So if you have calcium released from the ER, that those vesicles, excretory vesicles, don't care where the calcium came from, right? So if you had a hormone or some substance that activated the ER to dump out calcium, then you could have vesicular fusion, right? Exocytosis. So this is just to kind of remind us when we get to some of the hormones that some of them might work by activating a second messenger system that then work on the ER to cause calcium release that then can cause endocrine response. All right. So a gland, exocrine gland versus an endocrine gland. Your salivary glands, for example, are called exocrine glands to secrete fluid into your salivary system. And then, you know, there's a lot of substances that are released in their enzymes. Basic environment, bicarbonate, for example, water. And so, you know, your saliva, you can make a lot of it, right? Quickly, you get, sometimes you get nervous. You really secrete a lot, or right before you're getting sick, you know, you really get that whole mouthful of saliva. Well, those exocrine glands are really secreting and getting that fluid out, so they'll help you with that experience. Endocrine glands then, remember, into the bloodstream. So there's a difference of exocrine and endocrine glands. And we'll talk more about some of these later on in the GI system when we talk about gastrointestinal system. But mostly the endocrine glands are what we're going to focus on with this. Just to historically to kind of get you to think about how do people do these experiments a long time ago. It was really quite interesting because the early experiments were actually taking roosters, castrating them, and then they wouldn't develop the secondary sexual characteristics. So you can imagine people are trying to figure out how do hormones work? I mean, where did they come from and what tissue is making it? So some of the real early experiments were done with roosters, and then they could take a transplant of testes, put it in the animal, not even in the right location, but just keep it alive, maybe in the abdomen somewhere, and then they would start to change their secondary sexual characteristics. So they knew that something's secreted by that. So these are the early type of experiments that were done. They've done such experiments also in insects, with taking parts of an insect. Depends what book you might be looking at or web pages, but some really neat aspects. They would even take a part of a head of an insect and take out the hemolymph and inject that into another insect and watch the changes occur. So they knew it was blood-borne. The point is they could figure out it's blood-borne and then figuring out what tissue is secreting it. Nowadays, with molecular biology and antibody staining, people don't do these kind of old-fashioned experiments, but still, they're classic in understanding how they work. But it also tells you about the kind of the aspect that we've talked about, the environmental endocrine disruptors. Remember, we talked about the estrogens from plastics and plastic disposal and plastic hot pots and all that kind of stuff, right? And the Dow Corning experiment that we've mentioned about the different dishes of where they're growing breast cancer cells. So plastics, and now people are still addressing the substances that come out of plastics. There was a case in Italy a long time ago, I don't know if I mentioned that, where they were changing the dialysis tubing for dialysis patients, and all of a sudden they found many of these patients that were dying and having heart problems, and then they traced it down to changing the plastic in the dialysis tubing. And it was all because of a new company that they were working with at a reduced cost. So you can really get the idea plastics are great, but there's also some real concerns with what they might be leaking out. And that wasn't an endocrine, that was some other kind of substance that was released from them. So that's really bad. usually small molecules, but they might have an amine structure. The idea is, like neurotransmitters, when we talk about neurotransmitters, you get, you know, different shapes and sizes of them, and you can kind of then figure out, oh, is it going to go across the bilipid membrane, or is it going to bind to a receptor on the cell surface? What's the background? How are they made? So these are a little bit more complicated, because you can have, compared to neurotransmitters, you can have small molecules like an epinephrine here, an amine, small structure. Again, you can see that's charged there, and then it's going to, you know, dissolve into the blood, travel. You can have larger substances like these prostaglandins. These are really important too in many aspects, in immune responses as well as helping with your lung development. We'll talk more about that later. And then you can have steroids like testosterone and estrogen. And the backbone of steroids comes from, anybody remember biochemistry class? Did you cover this in biochem? Yeah, cholesterol, right? So cholesterol is important because the backbone of these, many of the steroids are coming from cholesterol. So estrogen, testosterone, we'll talk a little bit more about that later. And then you can have proteins, right, as hormones as well, like insulin. And some of these proteins, when they're first secreted by the main tissue, they're not actually maybe even active, or when they're first made. They might have to be even cleaved inside the cell or become active outside the cell that releases it. Like insulin, for example, it's a longer sequence, but part of it is chopped off and then has these disulfide bonds to make it strong, to make it really an active substance. So there's some really interesting aspects with how these hormones are actually made and different structures to them. I don't want you to have to memorize, you know, structure, but the main thing to understand, if it's a steroid, it can go through the bilipid membrane. If it's an amine or a peptide, it's going to bind to the receptors on the surface, right? And we'll talk about a little bit of steroids also have receptors on the surface of cells, but a lot of it can go right through cells, you know, right through your body, right? Okay, just kind of making sure we're all on the same page, you think about how can you regulate hormonal responses? Well, a main regulation is what we covered day one in here, negative feedback, right? You make something, it changes, and then maybe it increases your glucose level, your glucose goes up, then that feeds back and inhibits whatever might be raising your glucose levels, much like your temperature control, or your ionic concentration, or your water balance, right? It's the same idea. But the endocrine responses are a little bit more complicated, and we've seen some of these on MCAT type of exams where it can be a little confusing. So from past students that have said aspects of what they've seen on their Kaplan or other types of exams, I'll try to hit those for, you know, when they go through. But the idea is that you can have multiple feedback loops. Okay, so this kind of starts this memorization part, and which hormones are really the most important ones to try to remember. What's happening next week, this day next week? Quiz, right. And what's the quiz going to be over? Endocrine. We're all on the same page. Great. So this is why I'm trying to get you not to delay on this, to really get going. So the idea is to have this quiz so you can start to really review it this week and over the weekend, and then not delaying for the exam because there's just too much material. There is a lot of material to go over. I don't want you to delay studying for it. Okay, so we'll cover some of this repetitively today as we go through it, but the adrenal gland, remember the adrenal gland, right? Sits above your kidneys. That little gland, we talked about the adrenal medulla before. Remember the adrenal medulla is neural crest in origin. And it migrates down, and then other tissue grows around it, and that's the adrenal cortex. The adrenal medulla, being neural in origin, it acts like a postganglionic part of your sympathetic nervous system. So remember, postganglionic nervous system, sympathetic, what's it going to release? Epinephrine, norepinephrine, right? Into the bloodstream. So we're going to cover a little bit more about that. Let's go through here. So we just covered the medulla region, epinephrine, norepinephrine, in, like what we said, a sympathetic response. Now, the cortex region around the adrenal gland, it's mineral corticoids and corticosteroids. So, or glucocorticoids, you could say. So, mineral corticoids mean they control your mineral balance, your sodium balance, basically. And glucocorticoids, your glucose levels. But not only these hormones. Insulin, glucagon also do this. So the mineral corticoid is aldosterone. It works on your kidneys and causes sodium reabsorption. So I know we didn't cover the kidneys yet, but think, if you didn't excrete your sodium and you were able to reabsorb it, so sodium's going across the cell, what's going to follow? Water, right? So this is a way to increase your blood pressure, for example. If your blood pressure was dropping, you'd release the aldosterone, it would work on your kidneys, cause sodium reabsorption, water's going to follow, and that would raise your blood volume, and that raises your blood pressure. So you can think about, it's not just maybe the hormone that's a negative feedback, but actually raising blood pressure could be a negative feedback. We'll go into that a little bit more. So it's kind of interesting. So that increases sodium retention. From the other aspects, not just the mineral corticoids, but the glucocorticoids, cortisol is your stress hormone, right? If you're on a normal sleep-wake cycle, and I know most college people aren't, but if you're on a kind of a normal sleep cycle, you actually raise your cortisol levels before you get out of bed. Let's say you always wake up at 8 o'clock. Your cortisol levels probably rise around 6:30 or 7 if you're on the normal cycle. And then what's that doing? Getting your glucose ready to, for that stress of getting your feet out of the bed, right? Or turning off the alarm clock, just the stress of the day. You usually have another surge of cortisol in the late afternoon. So it's kind of interesting. People can actually monitor that and see how your glucose levels relate to this cortisol release also, but mostly to handle stress. Some people that are really into training and exercise, and you might hear coaches if you're on sports teams, that they say, you know, they want you in a normal sleep-wake cycle, and this is part of the reason, because they want your hormones to be working with your workout, with your exercise. If you were exercising before your cortisol levels naturally kind of cycled, then you're kind of raising them before you have your normal raise, and again in the afternoon. So some people actually try to work around this to complement the body's natural cycle with cortisol levels. This is also important if you're diabetic and you're looking at glucose monitoring. Your glucose levels might change based on cortisol release, not your insulin so much. So these are things to watch out for too. And we'll talk more about that when we get down the line. But also growth hormone can increase your glucose levels. And some people mess up their diabetic control because it's not from the insulin. It's actually these other hormones which they're not taking into consideration that can mess up your measurements and actually get you in some trouble with your insulin regulation. So it's interesting to kind of put this together, make sense out of it. We'll try to do that throughout this chapter. So you can see it's a little bit more complex than just one hormone for glucose, right? It's not just insulin and glucagon. It's growth hormone, it's cortisol, and how are they regulated? This is why this gets a little bit more confusing sometimes, so you want to keep up on this. Okay, so cortisol, if you're stressed all the time, that can raise that level and actually cause even muscle breakdown. I think we talked about gas, remember that, in the sympathetic system? Do you remember the dog with the fear? Did we talk about that? No, maybe? No, everybody forgot, or I went through it too quick. But it's like constant stress. It's not good, because then you can actually go into an exhausted stage, and you can actually have muscle breakdown. So some people that have cortisol shots all the time, maybe for allergies or asthma regulation, they actually can get degradation of their muscles because it's breaking it down. And so it's something to watch out for if you have too much of it. What happens if you, let's just use this as an example. Let's say you're injecting cortisol. What's the body going to sense as a feedback mechanism for the adrenal cortex? It's going to say, I have enough cortisol, right? Your cortisol level's already up because you're injecting it, right? So the body doesn't know where it came from. It thinks it came from a natural secretion. And then all of a sudden, you quit injecting it. But what happened to that tissue in the meantime? It probably said, hey, I'm making too much cortisol. Let's atrophy. Let's get smaller and smaller. Let's not make as much cortisol. So now you come off cold turkey. And now what's happening? and now you have a stressful event. You can't make enough to then to regulate that stress. So this is the problem with exogenous injections or taking of these hormones. You're fighting your own body, and you might be causing too much negative feedback, and then you can't have your natural release of these hormones when you need them. So you hear about this with athletes, for example, that are taking various substances. Okay, the medulla we talked about, the sympathetic system, epinephrine, norepinephrine. The GI tract, whew, there's so much in it. We didn't cover gastrointestinal yet, so I know some of these terms might be a little confusing. So we won't cover all the details here. We'll save some of those for when we cover the GI system, which is really important and growing. Interest in physiology is the bacteria in your GI system that you probably hear about in other classes or see in the news, how that can regulate your body. Weight, for example, or even your immune system, that bacteria in your GI tract has tremendous potential that people are finding more and more about all the time. But there's some hormones that we should remember and go over for even this endocrine chapter. And these are CCK, or cholecystin kinase. And as it says here, secretion of enzymes in the pancreatic cells, gallbladder contractions. So gallbladder contraction is important. Anybody think, what does a gallbladder do generally? It doesn't store urine. I had that as a trick question one time on an exam that people selected. It
stores bile.
Stores bile, right. And what does that bile do? It's injected into your intestine, into your small intestine. It helps break down fat, basically, too. It emulsifies the fat in your diet. And it also decreases the pH. It makes it more, increases the pH. It makes it more alkaline. It decreases the acidity of the solutions coming into your small intestine from your stomach. So the gallbladder is important. Causes gallbladder contraction. And that helps you with digestion. So if you had a fatty diet, if you had a fatty bacon this morning, and you had that in your stomach, that will actually trigger CCK, as an abbreviation, CCK, to then cause your gallbladder to contract and release the bile that can go into your small intestine and help you emulsify that fat, get you all ready for this. You've probably heard of people with gallbladder problems, right? Gallstones and things like that, right? Anybody ever hear of gallstones? Can be life-threatening, right? Because it backs up. If you have a gallstone, it can back up that bile that's made from your liver. And then where does that go? If it's backed up in your liver, it's not being released into your small intestine, where is it going to back up into? Your bloodstream, right? So that bile's not good in your bloodstream. This is when you see people maybe get acute liver inflammation, or even some diseases where their cornea will start to turn yellow, the skin turns kind of yellowish, and they usually have a liver problem, but it can be life-threatening. Some people that don't realize this, then at the last minute, they end up in the ER, and it's too late because their liver has quit working, and they can't function really without it. So there's a lot of interest with this. And you might hear about people that have gallstones, but they had their gallbladder removed. So you can talk to the your internal medicine docs here, and they'll tell you, they don't even ask patients sometimes if they have the gallbladder removed anymore when they come into the ER and they're having like real bad pain if you push on their stomach right here on the side of their abdomen, and it's usually like a gallstone or gallbladder inflamed. And they say, no, it can't be my gallstone because I have my gallbladder removed. They don't even care about that anymore because you're still making bile, and you can still get stones in the duct. And so they still can have gallstones even though you had your gallbladder removed. And there's different types of stones that can be made in your gallbladder. We'll talk a little bit about that when we get to the GI system, but just to kind of get you into the idea of it's really quite interesting. Okay, the other hormone that we really want to cover at this point is gastrin. So gastrin is really important in your stomach. So it helps with producing hydrochloric acid, HCl. You'll think about that. That's really bad acid, right? And that's around the pH of 1 or 2. Oof, pH 1 or 2 in your stomach, right? When you vomit, you realize what's in your stomach. It's burning your esophagus. It's burning your mouth. That's the HCl that's in there. And that's why also you make a lot of saliva to help protect your esophagus from that burning acid that's coming up. But you usually, when you eat, you're already secreting this to get ready for the food to come in. That's called the cephalic phase. It's your, mentally, you're getting ready to eat, or you might even smell some really good food in the morning, right? And then your stomach's already rolling because you're already producing this thinking that you're going to eat. Hopefully then you get some food down you, so it's not just this high acid. Okay, so that's really important too, because some people have, there's so many GI problems with people, ulcers for example, or this acid that has getting in contact with the epithelial lining, which is really bad. And that can happen, how? Because that mucus level goes away. And that mucus level that's inside your stomach protecting your cells is can be destroyed. One common problem with college students is alcohol takes away that mucus lining that's in there. And now what's going to happen? That HDL is directly exposed to the cells and then damages your stomach. So then they can produce bleeding ulcers, for example. So alcohol is not great in the sense of getting rid of that mucus coating and that protects your stomach. So moderation for things are pretty good to think about. Okay, so gastrin and secretin is the other one that we really want to talk about. So secretin increases the bicarb secretion by these pancreatic cells. So your pancreas will increase in the bicarb. So what does bicarb do if it's into the small intestine? It's going to neutralize the strong pH, the HCl that comes in. So again, it's raising the pH. It's making it more alkaline in the small intestine. Yes, question. Yes. So, gastrin-releasing peptide, it's an interesting point. It increases gastrin secretion, and then it decreases gastric acid and HDL. So this is supposed to be gastrin secretion. What happens here? That's a good point. So this might be gastrin-inhibiting. There is inhibitory peptides up there. That's supposed to decrease gastric secretion. Increase gastric secretion, decrease gastric acid, HCl. Well, that's an interesting one. I wonder if that's a typo. I did not catch that before. I will come back to that, okay? Good point, thank you. There is something that's interesting about the gastrin, that in the past there was something that was odd about something in this text that we're using. But I'll come back. This might be that point, actually. Good point. It might be increased gastrin inhibiting peptide that's actually active too. But we'll look at that. Thank you. So the other part is that these hormones, you'll hear about these hormones when you even get into the nervous system. Number of these hormones, you'll hear about gastrin that's in the brain. And you're going to wonder, what on earth is it doing in the brain? Our vasointestinal peptide in the brain. And it's just because they first identified it in the GI tract and then later found out it's also in the nervous system. And these hormones in the nervous system, like this point about gastrin-releasing peptide, these are really still kind of odd. What are they doing in the nervous system? And people really don't know a lot about many of these. I don't know if you've covered these in vertebrate endocrinology, any of these GI hormones. No. They're just that there's kind of strange that you can stain them up and that they appear in the nervous system, but people really don't know exactly what all these are doing. So you don't be confused if you do see these in, you know, some staining or something about in the nervous system. It's just they're there, but the higher levels are in the GI tract. Okay. More hormones. Phew, tables keep going on. This one's really neat. In the heart, and I know we didn't get into the circulatory system yet. How did your labs go on Monday, the EKG? Pretty good. It's a fun lab, right? Did you do the exercise and look at it? Did they do the diving response? So you put ice on your face? Saw it? That's pretty cool, too. And I don't know, did some people not have much of a response and other people had more of a response? Remember? Did they collect the data together? And I don't know if you had to write it up already. Did you have to write it up and already submit? Not yet.
I think the average response was, like, it dropped.
It dropped, generally it drops.
Yeah.
But you can usually take your class and divide your class up and find out, you know, that ice pack that you put on the face, the diving response, or cold water. you can actually find out who are smokers in your class and who are non-smokers in your class. Because the smokers generally decrease the diving response. They become insensitive. You've actually killed out some of your sensory responses for the diving response. So it's kind of neat. And the older you get, the less of a response. The diving response is really quite neat because sometimes when babies are born, it's a stressful delivery, and they have what's called supraventricular tachycardia, so supraventricular above the ventricle. So the atrium are beating too fast. Supraventricular tachycardia. Atrium are just beating too fast. What's going to happen if your atrium beat too fast? They can't fill up with blood, and they can't put blood into the ventricles. So they used to have to give like an injection. But what do they do now in the hospital? They can just take a cold rag, ice cold rag, and put it on the baby's face, slow the heart down, and it goes back into normal rhythm. Isn't that cool? Just with a diving response. And you wonder, why do they have that, right? And diving seals have that, diving birds have that, even iguanas have that, some diving animals have that are reptiles. So it's interesting that it's held over. And sometimes people that drink cold iced tea or something like that in the summer, a hot day, and they do that, they actually have slowing of their heart so much they might pass out. So it's kind of interesting to think about these kind of things. Some people are super sensitive to it. Okay, so interesting, this heart one here, atrial natriuretic peptide, in the history of this hormone, people didn't think that the heart could actually release atrial natriuretic peptide. Isn't that weird? It could be released from the atrium and your heart, the tissue in your heart. And what causes it to be released, I know we get into some of these aspects, but actually if the atrium stretched too much, then they release more of this. Isn't that interesting? So if the atrium stretched too much and you release more of this, what's that going to do? So this actually causes, it says, oh, your blood pressure is too high, right? So we want to reduce our blood pressure. How do we reduce our blood pressure? Get rid of the fluid, right? So if you increase salt and water excretion by your kidney, you're going to decrease your blood pressure. And then you won't have so much stretching on the atrium. That's kind of a neat feedback system, right? But to have the atrium release a hormone is really like, whoa, that was wild. And they discovered this up in Toronto, Canada, the physiology department. People at the time didn't believe it, but then now it's well accepted. The kidney releases hormones too. So we're not just thinking, you know, maybe when you hear endocrine, you're thinking of reproductive tissue or maybe the pituitary, but your other organs release hormones as well. So the kidney is really important for regulating calcium, but also for your blood, red blood cells. So your kidneys, this calciferol, can increase blood calcium and bone formation by increasing the absorption of calcium in your GI tract. So if you don't excrete it, but you increase the absorption of calcium in your GI tract and phosphate, that helps with raising your calcium in your blood. That's really quite neat. This one's really interesting, erythropoietin. So this increases from your kidneys, erythropoietin, and it also comes from another tissue we'll talk about later. But erythropoietin increases your red blood cells. So it then goes into your bloodstream, goes to your bone marrow, and increases your red blood cell count. So now, how could somebody with acute renal failure have an anemic response? You wonder why they might have an anemic response. Their kidneys aren't working right. If their kidneys aren't working right, they're not making erythropoietin. And now they're anemic all of a sudden. Right? They're not making enough red blood cells because they don't have the hormone, erythropoietin, being produced, and the RBC count goes down. So this is another problem with people like on dialysis, where the kidneys are not working right. They have to monitor their red blood cell count well because their kidneys might be failing to even make erythropoietin. So it's really quite neat to pull it all together. This is what's kind of fun about physiology, in a sense. Renin is also really important. We'll talk more about that later, but it comes from your kidneys, and it converts angiotensinogen, which is an inactive form, and like we talked about before, you know, something in the blood that can be activated. This is an inactive form, angiotensinogen, to angiotensin II. And angiotensin II is a potent vasoconstrictor. So if you wanted to raise your blood pressure, vasoconstrict your arterioles, right? Well, so we're going to come back to this. I know it's a lot. This is why I said there's a lot to this chapter. So we're going to come back to it in different ways. All right, let me talk about the kidneys too. But really important for your kidney function. So now you can see if you have kidney problems, it's not just
reabsorption or excretion of salts, but also making these hormones that then can cause your blood pressure changes, right? So really quite interesting. When we get to the reproductive hormones,
yes, question.
Why don't you say the angiotensin was again?
It's an inactive form of angiotensin 2. We're going to hit that again in a little bit when we get to the renin angiotensin system. But just now, just kind of think about it. Angiotensinogen is not active, but when it's converted to angiotensin 2, it's active. So if you had kidney problems, you might not be making the renin, and then that can cause problems. The reproductive hormones are really quite interesting. So we'll go through some of these, and it's complicated in some aspects, but the main points is what we want to get across. So the ovaries for female, estradiol, the active form, right, estrogen, the female secondary sexual characteristics, and then maintaining reproductive status. We'll go into more about that later, particularly with fertilization. And then the corpus luteum around the follicle that develops, it releases hormones too. Progesterone, increase in growth of the uterine lining for reproductive status and for maintaining pregnancy, and mammary glands, and also maternal behavior. So we'll go into a little bit more about that later. This is an interesting hormone, relaxin, that's released during pregnancy, for example, and it actually makes the birth canal easier to open up for delivering a baby. So it's really quite interesting how that works. Okay, so more hormones. I know it's like, oh my God, I'm going to go to sleep, right? So this is where you need the Red Bull when you're studying. Not too much of it, you know, just a little bit, because you want your heart rate to be crazy. But, and there is a lot, as I mentioned. So the pancreas, very important, right? And if you had anybody ever had a pancreatitis, you realize how important this is. But there's a lot going on in the pancreas, and this is on standardized exams, too, usually. So they might use this term, islets of Langerhans. So remember that these are in your pancreas, and this releases glucagon. So this raises blood glucose. Gluconeogenesis, what does this mean? Glucose, neo, new, and genesis, production. So it helps to produce glucose, new glucose, and glycogenolysis. So what is glycogen and then lysis? Glycogen is that storage molecule, right, of glucose. But lysis, break it down. So the net result in both of these is to increase the glucose levels, right? Increase the blood glucose levels. So glucagon to increase blood glucose levels by multiple mechanisms. One, to make new glucose, and two, break down the storage molecule of glycogen to glucose. Insulin, if you take a shot of insulin, for example, your blood glucose will drop. Why? Because it will increase the glucose to go inside of your cells, right? It increases glucose to go in the cells. So it decreases the blood glucose levels. The main point. Okay. We'll come back to some of these other ones a little bit later, but let's look at some of these other important ones. Parathyroid glands are really important in your thyroid gland. We'll cover the thyroid by itself later, but just right here to hear about parathyroid gland. These are around your thyroid, and they're really important for regulating blood calcium levels. So parathyroid glands, if they're activated, they can actually release parathyroid hormone that raises your blood calcium levels. And that's important for mobilizing calcium, right? Your calcium is important to be at a certain level in your blood for everything to work. We'll talk a little bit later about the pineal gland. I think we mentioned some of this before, being the third eye, right? And like fish and birds, that light can actually activate this and work on a cycle. But it releases melatonin, which you've probably heard on the news, or people take supplement melatonin and can, you know, help with your circadian pattern, supposedly. But it also changes gonadal development, so your gonads. It can actually decrease gonadal development. So this is something might not want to be giving this melatonin health food stuff to children that are prepubescent. Pituitary gland, there's so much to it that we're going to skip that right now, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. The placenta, when that develops, for example, you know, the pregnancy test, what is it that you're testing on the little cross, right? Is your chorionic gonadotropin, right? That, when implantation occurs, that will be starting to be released, and then you can measure that with very sensitive acid. So this is the pregnancy test, basically. All right, and we will get down to, let's skip this part, because we're going to cover that a little bit more later. The testes, two cell types in the testes that should be remembered. That's the Leydig cells and the Sertoli cells. And so we'll come back to all this again and again. But the Leydig cells for testosterone and the Sertoli cells, we're going to talk about this Müllerian regression factor. It actually regresses, it atrophies that. So then you become more male-like. In development, males and females are in an indifferent stage. And depending on the hormones that are released, you'll either go towards the male side or the female side. But sometimes those hormones get mixed up, right? Or environmental factors, like we talked about with the estrogen, can really mess up development for the reproductive system. So we'll talk more about this, but the Sertoli cells are important in this regression factor that causes an atrophy of this Müllerian duct, and it promotes the Wolfarian, another duct that we'll talk about and later on. Okay. We're almost through this table, and then we'll get to individual tissue. And then I think it comes back together again and again, because you hear it over and over again in different ways. And I think that's the easiest way. The thymus gland, people don't think about it that much. It kind of decreases with older age, but it's important for thymic hormones, and we'll talk about some diseases with that later on. I did put on the webpage endocrine problems, which I think might strike more of an interest. It's on the webpage when you pull down those PowerPoints. And it goes over main components of these hormonal problems that exist in humans, but also other animals. And it might help you for your, if you're taking standardized exams, to kind of be familiar with some of those. And it helps to reinforce some of these topics that we're talking about. Thyroid gland, really important, because your thyroid, thyroxine and thiazurone, or T4 and T3, also referred to as, that helps you in development. If you don't make these in normal development, your muscles will not develop right, your brain doesn't develop right, and also for animals like a tadpole where it regresses the tail, these are really important for development of amphibians like tail regression and legs to then be produced. So the thyroid gland is a very important developmental tissue, and T3, T4 is really important to be regulated right for normal development. And you've probably heard of older people, maybe grandma or parents, that are maybe taking Synthroid, the thyroid hormone. Usually, in older age, your thyroid seems not to be working very well. So they take thyroid hormone supplement. Usually it's like Synthroid, synthetic thyroid hormone. And it raises their metabolism a little bit. And then what else does it do? It raises their body temperature, right? You hear older people being cold all the time, right? Super cold, and they need to be checked to see if their thyroid levels are right. But it's really important when they do get onto these synthetic thyroid medication, usually they're going to check those patients every 3 to 6 months because they want to make sure they're in the right level, not having too much of it, because that increases your metabolism too much. And then it makes you more warm, and you feel you're burning up your glucose too much as well for your storage molecules. So, fine line in there. The thyroid hormones are really important. So, metabolic rate, if somebody felt lethargic all the time, you know, could be low thyroid hormone. All right. Calcitonin is a substance released by these cells that are around your thyroid called parafollicular cells. So, calcitonin. And if we remember, we talked about parathyroid. So parathyroid. So kind of keep these two together. A lot of the hormones are like a yin-yang effect. You know, one does this and the other does the opposite, right? Like insulin and glucagon. Here's an example, too. Parathyroid increases blood calcium. Calcitonin decreases blood calcium. And they're both tissues around the thyroid. So some of the problems that happened earlier on, you can look up lots of cases where this happened. People that might have too much metabolism, they feel hot all the time. So what do? They remove some of their thyroid, right? And you talk to your grandparents, they probably know, or your parents probably have met somebody, I'm sure, that probably had part of their thyroid removed. It was kind of an older-fashioned, That's something trendy. You know, trendy in medicine, basically. Lots of trendy things in medicine sometimes, and then they go away. And one of the trendy things were people that were too hyper were to remove part of their thyroid gland, because then you could decrease the thyroid hormone, and they wouldn't be so energetic. Not the best thing, maybe. But what happened early on is they removed too much of the thyroid gland, or a region of the thyroid gland, without looking for the parathyroid glands. And usually you have three pairs of them on your thyroid, but not always develop the same way. Sometimes those might not make the three pairs, right? They might stay as one globular unit. And then if you remove that, then you're taking away the parathyroid tissue.
Last week I saw a thyroidectomy and he turned out the glands.
Oh, you could see it?
Yeah.
So that's really cool. So she saw a thyroidectomy and you saw the parathyroid. Was it three sets?
Yeah.
So she was able to see it and it was definitive, right? Mm-hmm. So did they talk about sometimes they might not be three pairs? And so if they remove that thyroid and maybe it's inflamed or maybe it has a cancer, a thyroid cancer, and you might take out a big chunk of it, but if you remove the parathyroid tissue, then you're not regulating your calcium levels. So early on, that actually caused a lot of problems with people removing too much of the thyroid gland because you've removed the parathyroid. Anybody work in a lab with radioisotopes? No. This is a big problem that you might be working if you're working on like gels and you're running protein and Western blots, and maybe you're using radioactive iodine, for example. We'll talk about that later. They will want you to wear the radioisotope. If you're working with radioisotopes, you have to wear the radioisotope badge anyways to check to see if you've been exposed. But if you're working with radioactive iodine, which people used quite a bit to mark something that's being made, it's a real problem because your thyroid gland will incorporate that iodine, and if it's radioactive, it goes into your thyroid and can damage those cells. Early on, they actually gave people radioisotope iodine to kill out the thyroid gland if you wanted to reduce the tissue and not do the surgery. What's the problem with that, do you think? Radioisotopes, iodine, that then goes to your thyroid gland to help make T4 and T3, because we'll go through that. It's actually needed to make T3 and T4. And you're killing out that localized tissue with radioactive stuff. What else is around your thyroid gland? Thyroid gland, right? Your parathyroid, right? Calcium. What about everything else that's right there? Your lymph nodes, your esophagus, your trachea, all the other tissue. So people were getting esophagus tumors, destruction of all these other tissues because of the radioisotopes going out and actually killing other tissues that was healthy and that you didn't want to target. So they kind of got away from that, but there's a number of people that actually were damaged by the radioisotope iodine treatments to decrease the thyroid production. So I don't know if they even do that anymore. If you go back and you're seeing any more of that, ask them if they ever do that anymore. They might not. Maybe it's better just with surgery. But if you're in a lab, for example, they worry about you working with radioisotope iodine being incorporated in your thyroid. And so they usually do tests for that. Too much stuff. Okay, so we will come back a little bit later to some of these other factors. The one that I don't want to mention right now is secreted tissue. Somatomedins are really important. These are important because your growth hormone actually activates somatomedins that increases cellular growth and proliferation. So somatomedins are really important. And some people have defects in somatomedin production. It's not growth hormone production. Their growth hormones are fine, but the somatomedin doesn't get released, and then they don't develop right. So that's really kind of an interesting factor. Okay. So we talked about endocrine type of cells, very active, lots of vesicles there, being secreting. And now we talk about how they get into the bloodstream and a few particular topics. So neurons that then have their endings right onto the blood vessel. And remember we talked about, you know, action potential coming down, a lot of calcium entry. Then you could exocytose and get those substances right into the bloodstream. And people have looked at this type of conjunction. It's quite unique, but not too many people study it. But it's an interesting process. Basically, you're taking that into the bloodstream and it circulates to the bloodstream. But what if that target tissue, you know, is far away? And you just diluted that hormone into 5 liters of blood, right? So you dilute that hormone that you're releasing into 5 liters. That's a lot of dilution. So you'd want to, you know, maybe make release a lot. But what's another trick that could be done? Maybe have that blood stream, the next tissue that it perfuses is the target tissue of interest. And this is what happens in your anterior pituitary, for example, that we'll talk about in some cases. So here we actually can have hormones released in the hypothalamus region, picked up in the blood. It doesn't have to go too far before it works on the anterior pituitary. That's pretty cool, right? So it doesn't dilute out into the whole bloodstream so much before it hits that target tissue that it's actually interested in regulating. So releasing hormones from the hypothalamus, we'll talk about these in a little bit, releasing hormones, releasing the hypothalamus into the bloodstream, and the next target tissue of interest is right here, the anterior pituitary. The anterior pituitary is tissue that migrates into here during development, embryonic development. The posterior pituitary, think of that as an extension of the brain. So the brain extending out, like a finger of the brain pushing down. So this is neural tissue. So the release from the posterior is straight from the neurons into the bloodstream that then travel in the blood. But a trick question, maybe you had that in vertebrate endocrine, where is, say, oxytocin and vasopressin, the two hormones, or antidiuretic hormones, so just to remind you, antidiuretic hormone or vasopressin is the same hormone. They're used two different names, vasopressin or antidiuretic hormone, same. And then oxytocin is the other. So two hormones to remember for the posterior pituitary. Where are they synthesized?
Hypothalamus.
But a trick question. You're going to see a pituitary, posterior pituitary on an exam, and people will select that. That's where it's released from. But it's made in the hypothalamus, travels down the nerve, and is released from the... Is that what they taught you in vertebrate? Okay. So did they have that trick question on class?
I don't think so.
Okay. They didn't try tricky. But you'll see that on standardized exams, too. So don't be fooled by that, because it's an easy one to mistake it, right? So here you have these neurons that project. And I don't want you to have to memorize the different neuronal groups, just that the hypothalamus, okay? You can memorize the different types of neurons and their groups for making vasopressin or oxytocin in another course. But the main idea, these neurons project their endings right down into the posterior pituitary and release these two hormones to remember. There's a whole bunch to remember in the anterior pituitary, and that's what we're going to go through. There is this other tissue that's between these two. That's called the par intermediate. And this is melanocyte-stimulating hormone. In some animals, this is actually very enlarged when they want to control melanocytes, like the pigmentation in the skin, for example. Animals that change their colors, this could be enlarged for that. But in us, it's relatively small. So par intermediate for melanocyte-stimulating hormone. The anterior pituitary, wow. Growth hormone, prolactin. Thyrotropin, follicle-stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone, adrenocorticotropin, or AC. We'll talk more about these as we go through them. So there's a lot of hormones to remember with the anterior pituitary, but only two you have to remember for the posterior pituitary. All right? A few more minutes of chaos, and we'll get through some of this. So another table. Whew. Lots of tables. So this one, read the titles of these so it'll help you put it together. The hypothalamic neurohormones that stimulate or inhibit release, and the androhypophyseal hormones. So mostly we're talking about this anterior pituitary, and the names are really pretty good to try to help you remember what they do. Corticotropin releasing hormone. Anytime you see the releasing hormone, they're made in the hypothalamus, and they're working on the anterior pituitary. So growth hormone, releasing hormone, right? So that makes sense. It works on the anterior pituitary to grow growth hormone. Gonadotropin-releasing hormone, what does it do? Well, gonadotropin, FSH and LH. So that's, you know, straightforward. TSH, our thyroid-releasing hormone, that then releases for the thyroid gland to then make more thyroid, but also some prolactin increase. Inhibiting hormones like MSH inhibiting hormone, prolactin inhibiting hormone, and I think they, did you cover that one in vertebrate? Do they call that dopamine now, pretty much?
We didn't cover that one.
Okay.
I think this has been pretty much changed in the way this works is a dopamine is used for this term now. And then somatostatin, also a growth-inhibiting hormone, or GIH. So some of these have multiple names, and this is where people get confused. They thought, oh, on the exam, I thought it was this one. In our class, what I try to do, for example, is give you both names. But on standardized exams, they might not, right? So if you're studying for MCAT or some other dentistry exam or PA exam, they might be using one name or the other. So when you're making your note cards, you might want to write down both names. I know it's a lot. It's like that's what I told you in the email. It's just like, but it's interesting, but there's a lot to remember. Okay. Just think about these small, some of these are small peptides, some of them are bigger peptides. That's the main point to get out of this. So if we look at the anterior pituitary now, so we went from the hypothalamus releasing hormones that either activate or inhibit the anterior pituitary. Now we're in the anterior pituitary, right? So we're talking about those hormones that were released from the hypothalamus into the bloodstream, the next target tissue in the bloodstream, anterior pituitary. And now we have a lot of hormones to think about in the anterior pituitary. Let's go through some of these. So adrenocorticotropin hormone, or ACTH, it's usually pretty good to try to memorize these smaller abbreviations. And you might see these just on an exam without the whole name, so you want to remember both of these. If we have open response questions in here, you can just use these abbreviations, okay? So ACTH, where is it going to work? So it's from the anterior pituitary. It works on the adrenal cortex. Well, what does the adrenal cortex do? Adrenal cortex, whereas we talked about mineralocorticoids and glucocorticoids, right? So it's going to work on the adrenal cortex and activate the adrenal cortex. And then you can think about what that does. FSH and LH, follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. The problem is people get confused because of the names of these, the follicle for females, right? You make the follicle, and the luteinizing hormone, the corpus luteum. They think, you know, sometimes you're going to get confused and you won't think it has any action in males. They have action in males, too. It's just that they were given these names because they first found out what their function was on the follicle or the corpus luteum, for example. So they call them the follicle-stimulating hormone or luteinizing hormone. But pay attention, they also work in males and for development, but also for normal production. Okay, so follicle-stimulating hormone, think of the follicle. It increases the follicle, stimulation of the follicle. But also, then what's the kind of the equivalent of the follicle in a male? Well, sperm. So it increases the sperm production, just like it increases the follicle. So this way, it's not so confusing about what's going on with the male and the female for follicle-stimulating hormone. All right, luteinizing hormone. It helps with the corpus luteum in females, which we'll get more involved with there. But also then in the males, it increases the synthesis of androgens, you know, testosterone. In the female, the corpus luteum releases progesterone. So you can think of the corpus luteum for progesterone, and you can think of the males then for androgens, like testosterone production. So this will help to maybe put those two together. But don't get confused. Again, FSH and LH working both in males and females. And then we get to the thyroid-stimulating hormone, or TSH. So thyroid-stimulating hormone is going to activate the thyroid, and we just talked about the thyroid. It releases T3 and T4, raises your metabolism, increases growth, lots of things, and we'll come back to each of these tissues as we go along. Okay, so I know there's a lot there to take in, and I think the easiest way to really study for this, too, is not just the note cards, but take out blank pieces of paper and kind of write it out, especially the pituitary, anterior and posterior, and some of the hormones and which ones work on the pituitary tissues, and then what do those hormones do that are released. So these kind of will really help you, this kind of figure. You might want to start or make one yourself with blank paper. Hypothalamus, you know, can be positive or negative depending on the hormones. Anterior, then releasing ACTH, TSH, FH, LH, what do they do? What's their function here? And then we talked about the growth hormone and the parasomnia media, right, or melanocyte-stimulating hormone. And then what does it do? You know, metabolism, really important, but also thyroid-stimulating hormone is also very important for metabolism. And then the negative feedback process.
So this is where it can be a little confusing. These can then change a level of a hormone like LH or FSH, but then that can come back and have a negative feedback onto the hypothalamus. A really good one is the thyroid releasing hormone that then causes TSH to be released. That TSH causes the thyroid to release T3, T4, and now the T3, T4 can go back and inhibit the thyroid, but also there can be some feedback back on the anterior pituitary and even on the hypothalamus. So there's a lot of feedback mechanisms. So people like Endocrine is really kind of neat. It's like a investigative story. We had a student that worked in our lab for a number of years, and she went to med school, and she did the rotation in the ER, and she hated blood, and she passed out all the time when, you know, the patient was screaming or something like that. She just couldn't handle that. And she found out what she was really interested in, working out endocrine problems. So she went up to NYU, New York University, did her residency there in pediatric endocrinology. And she just loves this field because it's like a mystery, solving these problems. Where is the feedback? You know, you have too much of the thyroid, maybe, hormone being released. Maybe it's a cancer. Or maybe it's the anterior pituitary is releasing too much stimulating hormone. It's not the thyroid, right? Or it's maybe the releasing hormone, the higher up in the hypothalamus. So working it out to actually find out where the problem is. And she's really good at this aspects. So, you know, there's other areas that you don't have to see blood and guts, but you can still, you know, really solve some really neat problems. The posterior pituitary, just maybe we'll end with this because I'm sure you're saturated already. Anterior pituitary, we covered in the pars intermedia. And the posterior pituitary, remember where these two hormones are made, hypothalamus, right? And oxytocin and ADH. So antidiuretic hormone, just what it stands for, antidiuresis. So decreasing urine output, antidiuresis. So it works on your kidney to help with water reabsorption. So water reabsorption, then you don't pee as much. You don't have as much diuresis. So antidiuretic hormone, decreasing the urine output. And that increases water absorption. It's really interesting what it does. It goes to the kidney and works on the part of the nephron. It's the individual unit in the kidney, which we'll talk about later. But it actually can cause these proteins, this channel, to go into the plasma membrane and what's called an aquaporin, a water channel. People, when aquaporins were discovered, they actually boo-hooed the person that described those. They said, you can't have a water channel that goes into the membrane. That doesn't make sense. It's silly, you know? And they criticized him for years until he kept going at it and then finally realized, oh, there are such things called aquaporins, and they sit underneath the membranes, kind of like those AMPA receptors we talked about in, you know, with depression, synaptic depression or facilitation or long-term potentiation. It's the same idea. These proteins are underneath the membrane and can get incorporated into the membrane. And if you put an aquaporin, a water channel, in there, then you can reabsorb more water so you don't make as much urine. And that can then raise the blood pressure back up and have a negative feedback. But if you raise the blood pressure or you dilute the salts, right, that can then regulate the release from the hypothalamus. So that's pretty neat. Oxytocin is really kind of an interesting hormone too, so that's very important for uterine contraction and mammal glands for milk prolactin, for ejection. So sometimes females that have just given birth, for example, and they might hear a baby crying, they might have milk let down. It's not for their own baby, but just that auditory sound can cause this hormone to be released and have a milk letdown. So it's kind of interesting what regulates this from hearing, you know, a baby crying, then causing milk letdown. So that's pretty interesting to think about also. Oxytocin is also what you hear about with the, what, positive feedback, right? Yes, anybody? Didn't we talk about that like the first day of class or something? Instead of negative feedback, this is the common one that's used for an example of a positive feedback. So during parturition, when child birthing is occurring, and you're stretching the uterus, this then will cause more oxytocin to be released, and then that causes more contraction of the uterus, and then it's stretching, and then more released until parturation is complete, until child delivery is complete. You've probably heard of getting oxytocin injections to speed up the contraction for delivery, so that's part of it too.
So it's really quite neat. Oxytocin also considered a bonding hormone. So you might have heard of this in maybe in your ecology class, where they've taken mice, for example, a female mouse and a male mouse, and they will inject the female mouse only when mouse A male is around. And then you put another mouse, this male mouse, let's call him B, around the female, but you don't inject oxytocin. And you keep doing this back and forth. And you only inject oxytocin when it sees the male mouse named A. And then you can put them together, and the female will prefer male mouse A. So it's kind of interesting. This is why it's considered a bonding hormone for this reason. And so that's kind of neat to think about. All right? So I think we've had enough of hormones for a while, right? Have we? Okay. So what we're going to try to do is to wrap up this chapter. There's a lot still to it, because I'm just flipping through these. And you can see the idea that there's a lot in there. So I would definitely look over this. We're going to try to finish this up on Thursday. We'll take that little quiz on Monday. Hopefully look through some of the endocrine problems. I mean, not Monday. Tuesday. And then hopefully get through some of the endocrine problems and then move on. If you didn't pick up your quiz from before, on March the 6th, we have them up here.